Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. This is your morning show host, Julie Calamine, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Huff. Good morning, Phil.
Morning. Happy New Year, Julie.
Well, thank you, and Happy New Year to you, too.
Yeah.
Say, I do need to mention for those of you that have been listening at the 7 o'clock hour that we had a computer malfunction with our Democracy Now!, so we have not canceled Democracy Now! In the new year. We just had a glitch. Should be returning tomorrow.
It'll be Democracy later.
That's very true, Phil. Very true. Anyway, good morning to all of our listeners, and it's a happy new year. We've got an interesting show this morning, but I'm going to start with a little weather, and then we'll introduce our guest, Matt Haig. Plan today, everyone needs to plan on a little bit of weather. There's going to be a slight chance of snow, and then snow likely today with a high of 32. I also heard that we might be having a bit of icy roads later today, Phil.
Well, it makes sense because there was a beautiful sunrise driving in. You know, there's that old adage about red skies at night, sailor's delight, and red skies in the morning, sailors take warning. So if you're planning on being out sailing on Lake Pendere today, take warning.
Or drivers take warning, one or the other. Anyway, tomorrow is more of the same and similar thereafter. Good for skiers and maybe a little bit tough for drivers. Mm-hmm. We've got a rainy, wintry mix tomorrow on Wednesday. Same tomorrow night, rain and patchy fog. Sort of same temperatures with highs in the middle and upper 30s, lows in the low 30s and high 20s. So it is winter in Sandpoint. We've got skiing, we've got snowshoeing, and we have cloudy, damp weather. But that's it.
We also have the closing, the end of a couple of the hunting and trapping seasons. And so we're at a transitionary point in the year for many activities. And today we have on the show Matt Haig. For those who listen on a regular basis, they will, along with us, welcome Matt back to the show. Matt's conservation officer for Idaho Fish and Game, and welcome, Matt.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Great to have you. You're so knowledgeable, and for that reason, we've overloaded our outline with many, many topics, and we'll do the best we can to get to most of them, Matt.
Sounds good.
So be prepared. Well, anyway, can you start by telling us just a little bit about yourself? You've been with us before, but not every listener would have heard from you before. So tell us about how you came to be working as a conservation here in North Idaho.
I'm what they call a conservation officer, what most people call across the country a game warden. My career began at University of Montana. I had a wildlife biology degree. My girlfriend at the time came over to work for Idaho Fish and Game and said, "Why don't you come over here and check this department out and see if you want to be an officer over here?" And I did. I really enjoyed it. I like how the officers here work with our wildlife biologists. They're not just law enforcement. And that's how my career started. In Lewiston, I was first stationed, and then I went to Orofino. And then I've spent the last 15 years, I believe, do some math there, here in Bonner County.
So did you come up to Bonner County purposefully or just luck into it?
Just lucked into it. My wife, Becky, was working in Coeur d'Alene. I took a job as a wildlife technician at the Trout Creek, the Hunter Ranch there. And then I got on an enforcement and transferred down to Lewiston, and I knew I wanted to come back. So if people remember J.J. Scott, he was the Clark Fork officer, and when he retired, I jumped on it and was able to move up here.
Kind of a dream job, I would think, for any person conservation, fish and game related. Idaho, wow.
It is, yeah.
Yes.
North Idaho, or Northern Idaho, is where old game wardens go to die, so they say. So everyone tries to transfer up here, and I was lucky to transfer up at an early age.
Yes, good for you. Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about the work you do. What is a day in the life of a conservation officer like here in the Panhandle?
Well, every day is different because it's driven by the phone calls and activities that are happening out there. But a normal day, I'm doing about 50 to 55% enforcement. The other percentages of time, I am doing education, like hunter education, doing presentations. Then we do a little bit of biology work for our biologists, whether that's helping with population counts or, there's so many things out there, trapping bears, whatever it may be. And that's pretty much a day in the life. It's driven by my phone. I could wake up plan on doing nothing and the phone rings. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get a cat out of a trap.
You're based in Clark Fork, but you have a pretty large turf you cover.
I do. I cover eastern Bonner County, so right up the Selkirk Crest. I cover the upper pack, which is actually Boundary County, but I cover that right across the county line to the Montana state line, all the way down into Jordan Camp in Shoshone County, back around the lake to Laclede. So it's not the biggest by any means. We have some officers that have 2,000 square miles. I have about 700.
Mm-hmm. still pretty
when you factor in all that terrain, it's not even a flat map.
Right. So no, it's not hard easy to get around in.
It is, yeah.
So we were talking before we began our program this morning, and I asked if you were outside quite a bit still, and you said, yes, you were. So you really do have, you're in and out and outdoors every day, just about.
Just about, yeah. I joke with people, I say I don't work when it's dark or raining or snowing, but that's not true. yeah, we're out quite a bit, and that's part of the reason that I think all of the officers take a job, because we want to be outside and not sitting behind a computer. You know, that we want to work with wildlife and work with people. So even when we don't need to be outside, we're still outside because that's where we want to be. But yeah, this time of year, we're outside quite a bit dealing with depredations, meaning elk or deer that are coming into haystacks. We have a trapping season going on. So we're out there quite a bit.
All right. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wanting to mention this several times during the morning show program because I think it's important that people know they can contact you if they see a game, any kind of strange game thing happening. What's the best way for people to reach Fish and Game if they see something that doesn't seem right?
The best way is to call the non-emergency number at Bonner County Dispatch.
Okay.
It's 265-5525. Mm-hmm. And they can get a hold of us via phone or on the radio. So they're the most efficient at getting a hold of us.
Yeah, so that actually brings up an interesting topic about how you, Idaho Fish and Game, intermingle with the Sheriff's Department and other authorities. So tell us a little bit about where the jobs cross over.
It's, well, we pride ourselves on having a good working relationship because we rely on the county, which we don't pay for. The county supplies us a dispatch for free. And we try to have a great working relationship with the deputies and the city officers as well because we're all in the same business and we have each other's back. So it's really important that we work well together. And I think we do here. I'm very lucky to work with Sheriff Wheeler and Chief Kuhn and their officers. And so.
And does it get a little complicated sometimes? Whose case is it? Or is it quite clear for you all to understand who should be working on what?
It's very clear. Yeah. We're completely focused on wildlife and we can help with any other thing. If I'm the nearest to, let's say, a domestic violence, I will go. I will back up those deputies, those officers, because we are, as game wardens, we are certified peace officers of the state. So our jurisdiction is the state with all laws, but we tend to focus on wildlife because that's who's paying us, is the hunters and anglers. Mm-hmm. The state doesn't pay for our enforcement, so.
Yeah. The job gets even bigger, not only animals, but helping out with the sheriff's department.
Sure, yeah.
You have a lot going on. So let's move on to the current seasons. What's still open? What are people still hunting for?
We have mountain lion season with hounds. We have grouse season. We have a new squirrel season. We have trapping season for fur bears and wolves. And I believe that's it. Mm-hmm. You can go ice fishing. You can find some good ice.
Yeah. Enforcement of violations on the ice are probably easier than those in the boat, though. At least you can track them down more
easily, right? Exactly.
There you go. Well, tell us a little bit about the 2018 hunting season. How did it go? Do you have our numbers in? Has everyone reported in on what they've been able to capture?
They're slowly coming in, but it takes a while for us to compile all that data. And then we compare that with helicopter surveys. So it takes a while to really see what that data means. We kind of get a general sense at just being out in the field. And sometimes that's wrong. But this year, at least in my area, is a little bit slower than typical. Even hunter numbers were down in my area. That's not necessarily true for people surrounding. Like the Boundary County had more hunters than they typically do. So.
So what can you tell us anything about what that means for the population trends for some of the animals that I guess hunters are most concerned with, the elk and deer and such?
Sure. I think a lot of people went up to Boundary County just because of the new depredation hunts that we have, where you can be within a mile of private land or cultivated land. And so that's appealing to some hunters. And there's a lot of country like that in Boundary County and not so much in Bonner County. So a lot of hunters head north for that opportunity.
And were the depredation hunts for elk or other species?
Elk and deer.
Oh, yeah. Deer too.
We've had a growing population of elk in the valleys. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, that's because they're running away from wolves. And well, elk don't run from scary things. They would never live in the mountains if that were the truth. Yeah. So they stay put. The lead cow teaches them, you know, how to work through the land, and so they don't come into the valley floors to get away from wolves or mountain lions. But we've had no cow seasons, and we've had some fairly mild winters, so the herds in the valley are really blowing up, especially when they can get access to hay. I mean, great feed. Mm-hmm. They're living high on the hog, so to speak. So
for the non-hunter listener, tell us what the depredation hunt's different from a regular hunt.
Well, I guess I should. There's a depredation hunt. Like, we'll give someone a depredation tag where they can kill elk off of a haystack. That's basically just deterrence. So the herd sees a cow go down and they don't want to come back. We also have the controlled hunts that were related to depredation hunts, where we allowed people to shoot cows within a mile of private or cultivated.
Mm-hmm. And ordinarily, you can't do that.
Correct. Right. Yes. That's a brand. That's the second year of those hunts.
Yes. And when will Fish and Game know if they will continue with cow seasons? Is that known yet?
By April, when the new regulations, we're on a 2-year regulation cycle, and that goes back to what I was explaining with the data coming in from harvest data and the helicopter surveys. So they like to do 2 years out because they can kind of get a picture of what's happening out there. Mm-hmm. And so they will decide sometime in April. And then the regulations will print out, and then we'll have 2-year cycle 2019-2020.
Okay, but obviously the news has been good for elk if the state has been able to do depredation hunts. What about moose? What do we know about the moose season?
Moose population's declining, and we're going to have a 50% reduction in tags available up in the panhandle, or at least in the northern panhandle. It's twofold. The warmer winters are killing off the parasites that moose are typically exposed to. So that's taking a huge toll across the whole United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. So that's not just an Idaho thing. And then you couple that with wolves, and there is some serious depredation by wolves on moose. Mm-hmm. They can't get away from them. That's the number one prey for wolves in the wintertime. And so you have a declining population with another mouth and stomach to feed out there, and it's not a pretty sight.
And so the parasite, it's actually the warmer winters are allowing the parasites to thrive.
Correct.
Yes. Where previously the colder winters would kill them off.
Yes.
Yes, right.
Those parasites have always been around. They kind of ebbed and flowed. Now we're seeing is consistent and more parasite load, especially those older bulls. They'll be so parasitic laden that some hunters refuse to eat the meat, and I can't blame them. And you look at it and once you butcher it yourself, and you just can't get that out of your head when you're going to put it in the frying pan or the oven. So.
Quite an issue and not an easy one to figure out.
It's not. It's really not. So it'll just have to play out and see.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So the aerial surveys, are they for only the elk, or are they for all the ungulates? Tell us a little more about that. I think there was a recent news article about the aerial surveys taking place just south of here.
Yes, there is. They're starting to do the surveys in Unit 4, and they have a collar project going on, too. So they're putting collars on calves of the young of the year to see survival rates. Mm-hmm. Typically, we don't fly north of, say, Athol. It's just too timbered. We don't get good data. And that's probably one of the few places in the state where we don't do helicopter surveys for population dynamics. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a valuable resource. And it is for all ungulates, mostly mule deer and elk is what they fly for, because they'll herd up in the southern part of the states and they can get a very good or an accurate account.
So if flying north of Athol is problematic because of the timber, what are the methods used to come up with the same population or similar population estimates?
Well, they look at harvest rates. So let's say it's a 17% success rate. And then for 3 years, we're seeing a 12% success rate. Mm-hmm. That's an indication that the population's going down, because hunters are typically pretty
consistent in their behaviors. Yeah. So we just started to touch on mule deer, and I'm wondering what you know about mule deer on the panhandle. How are they doing?
They're doing okay. It's kind of alarming. I haven't really seen a large harvested mule deer in a few years. And that could play into predation as well. They're very susceptible to wolves and mountain lions, which we have a ton of mountain lions.
And what about those mountain lions? Are there lots of hunters? If there are lots and lots of mountain lions, are we seeing an increase in the number of mountain lion hunters?
That's a good question. I don't think that we are, just because it is so involved. You have to have hounds. You have to have the time to do it. You have to have the resources, snowmobiles, those kind of things to get out there and really consistently hunt and hunt well. So I don't know if the numbers are going up, but it may be, because when you think about what's happening in the Western states, a lot of them are discontinuing their hound hunting for mountain lions. So those hound hunters in Oregon and Washington and California, they come to Idaho. They'll move to Idaho because they love cat hunting so much. So,
and people eat them.
Yeah, they're good.
Yeah,
they're good.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be something I'd think might be a delicious game animal.
Yeah, but you don't generally think of carnivores as a food animal.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. I've only had the backstraps, and they're delicious. I mean, it was equivalent to a pork tenderloin.
Interesting. So, very interesting. Well, we have to touch on the bird season, Matt, because I've had several requests from hunting friends that want to hear what's happening with grouse and turkeys, et cetera.
All right. Turkeys, they're kind of they're a pain. As I bet anybody out there would say, they're just, their populations are growing. They're a menace. So we've got some pretty liberal seasons on them. To December 31st, I think you can kill 7 birds. I think what we need to do is reduce that cost though, because people look at $18 for one tag for a,
wow. No,
yeah. And yes. So it's not very
so it doesn't conducive lend itself to, yeah, right. to getting more turkeys harvested.
Describe the menace. I think many people would agree, but for different perspectives. So tell us what you're
in
thinking.
In so many ways, Phil.
Livestock, they're a menace because they get in the hay and then they defecate in the hay and it makes it disgusting for their animals to eat. And then I feel bad for the people who have neighbors that feed. Mm-hmm. And so they're getting, 60, 80 turkeys going through their yard on their deck, defecating on their deck. And it's just, they're
messy.
Yeah.
And I think we might need more turkey recipes. I'm not sure that people know what to do with their turkeys when they get one.
They do pound them.
tenderize.
Yes, yeah. Tenderize the meat.
Anecdotally, they do seem to be on the increase. But is there any way to actually qualify or estimate that? Is it a cyclical thing? Do their populations go through boom bust?
They do go through boom bust. It's spring weather related. So if they're clutch, their babies, their nests, if they fail due to cold weather or rain. Mm-hmm. They will reclutch. Turkeys will reclutch. But if it's still cold and rainy, they'll lose a bunch of birds. If it's warm and nice, then we can have a double clutch and have that many more birds. Yeah. So it's very spring weather related.
True. Yeah. And I get the question, were turkeys ever native to Idaho? Were they a native bird at one time?
I don't believe in the panhandle they were, but I do believe in southern Idaho they were.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
They've certainly colonized well in the north. They love it here.
They do.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Another question that comes up related to turkeys, and I'm hoping that you can give us some insight on this, is the turkey-grouse relationship. Is there any connection or not really?
I've heard that, and I would tend to not think so. I think it's all weather-related. They're not competing for food. They're not competing for space. It's just you're seeing that cyclical drop in grouse as weather, weather-related mm-hmm. activity, so...
Makes sense. That makes sense.
So their population boom bust cycles were differently related differently to the dynamics of spring weather.
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
And I also read that there's been a bit of research into West Nile virus and its effect on grouse. I think that might be in Minnesota, but that's yet to be discovered.
Too. Oh, interesting. I haven't read anything about that. So
new. I just saw it a couple weeks ago.
Okay. So. Interesting.
Now, as I recall, the turkeys here, there's really actually 3 species of turkey here. Is that right?
In the panhandle, we have Merriam's.
Merriam's. Just yes. Merriam's.
Just okay. Merriam's, yeah.
Okay.
Those turkeys, we could go on and on, but I think what we're going to do is take a short song break, and then we're going to change subjects again because we've got so many. We'll move on to trapping when we return.
All right.
In honor of the wild turkey and the wild grouse, we'll be hearing Michael Martin Murray's song for the new year, Phil, Wild Bird.
Yeah. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, this is 88.5 FM KRFY, listener-supported radio for North Idaho. And we're joined today by Matt Haig, Conservation Officer for Idaho Fish and Game. Comes in about every time this year. We talk about the fall hunting season, segueing into the winter trapping season, and everything that's happening and new in the department. And we'll get to that stuff, the new stuff, in a little bit. But for now, let's turn from hunting to trapping.
Great. Yeah.
Tell us in general about the how the seasons are distinct for those who aren't accustomed to hunting and trapping in general, in terms of timeline, calendars, et cetera.
Well, most of the fur bearers or trapping seasons start sometime in November, get into December a little bit, and they'll go through February. And so it's pretty short season, and I give trappers all the credit in the world. It is a ton of work. They have a 72-hour trap check time. So every 72 hours, they have to individually see every single trap out there. A lot of work, a lot of money, but very rewarding, too.
Yeah, and what are they trapping, Matt? What species are considered trappable?
There's a bunch, but the main ones are pine marten, bobcat, beaver, and wolves. So those are the main.
Sure, and there are others, but maybe not as commercially important, something
correct.
Like that.
Yeah.
No, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And wolves aren't really much fur bearer. People aren't trapping them for fur. The market's down. It's more of a population control. That even though it's nice to have a tanned wolf hide, that fur is, it's not a marketable fur. Yeah. Whereas bobcats or coyotes or pine marten, it could very well be, with prices, depending on prices.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Do you find a lot are doing it for commercial or personal use?
I think it's a mix. Some of it's personal, just to have fun, just to get the kids out. Mm-hmm. They only have, 10, 12 traps versus someone who's doing it commercially will have 50, 75 traps out there. So it's definitely both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I'm just not very familiar with trapping, so I'm learning as we're talking, but, what is trapping about in terms of the whole process? You've mentioned the 72-hour turnover checking, but there must be a lot of involvement in terms of what sort of equipment people use and how they select a trap line, et cetera.
There's really not a lot of regulations regarding that. I mean, the big one's a 72-hour trap check time. That's the big one. There are some recommendations we make with certain types of traps. Like, for instance, I mean, I could use these names most people won't understand, but a 330 conibear, big trap, body gripping trap. We recommend that you don't have that on dry land because you could catch somebody's dog. And even though it's not a law, it's one of our recommendations. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a ton of, it's not highly regulated in the sense where, say, you can only have a trap line here. You can only use these kind of traps. It's pretty open.
There's very few places where they're excluded from.
Correct. Yep. Right. Any public land they can trap on. Any private land with permission they can trap on.
Okay, yeah. That was going to be my next question. Where might a person encounter a trap? And they can be on ground, they can be underwater, right?
Yeah, if they're trapping beaver, they'll be underwater. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So what's the best way for those who are out winter recreating with their dogs to do that safely?
The best way is to honestly have a dog on a leash. I have dogs. I realize it's hard to keep them on a leash, especially when you're out in the woods. You want them to run free and have some fun. One good way is to look at boot tracks. Where are they going? Most trappers, they're not lazy. They're just being efficient. So they're very close to roads and very close to trails. There are some laws that designate they can't trap in a road bed, like a Forest Service road bed that's open to public travel. And it's owned by a public agency. They have to be outside the roadbed.
What about the right-of-way? Is that an area that they can trap, or is that considered the roadbed?
That is not considered the roadbed. They can trap in that right-of-way right there, as long as they're off the roadbed.
And within trails, they can be not on the trail, but fairly close to it.
They can. They can be within 5 feet of the center line. And that may be changing, which I think is a good thing. And that's my personal opinion. And most trappers don't trap that close to a trail.
Right.
Some do when they're not expecting winter travel from people. And they feel, I mean, I don't know a trapper out there, and I know almost all my trappers, they're mortified when they catch a dog. It's not something that they want to have happen at all. So.
But to keep your dog safe, keeping him on the lead, make sure that the dog stays within 5 feet of the trail then. So
yeah, and if it's a new trail, you're just hitting that trail for the first time this winter, keep him on the lead or her on the lead until you're comfortable with what's out there, if there's traps or not. It's very evident when there's traps.
Right. Sure.
And
As a comparison, when folks are getting ready to hunt bears and they set out bait, are they required to put something out so we're aware there's bait out for bears?
There is, but most times the public won't see the tag. It's a small, it looks like a wristband.
Okay.
And it's a little, this year it was a blue band, and you can put it somewhere in the tree next to the bear bait. And that doesn't, you can't bear bait in Unit 1. So anything north of the Pend'Oreille River, north of Pend'Oreille Lake, or north of Clark Fork River, that's not open to baiting.
Okay. So, what is Fish and Game's, I don't know if, you probably can't speak for all of Fish and Game, but is there a general consensus about bear baiting in the state? Is it positive, thought of positively?
There's a couple different thoughts on that. Personally, I like bear baiting because it's a great tool to be able to identify a target. Is that a sow with cubs? You have time to look at the whole situation, where if you're just out, let's say you're deer hunting and you come across a bear and the first reaction is, oh, there's a bear, let me shoot it. And then, oh no, there's two cubs.
Yes, or the species of bear too.
That's exactly. Right. You get time to sit there and look and say, hey, that's a grizzly bear. That's not a... So then the other thought is we shouldn't be feeding bears. And that's why we don't do it in Unit 1, where you could come across a grizzly bear. We don't want bears to get accustomed to human foods and those scents and that kind of activity. Sure. So there's two school of thoughts there.
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive with a food storage order in place on the Forest Service and having to lock those things away or hang them or put them in bear-proof boxes than to put them out.
Right.
Yeah, so right.
I think it is a little different, though, when you have... because those bear-proof boxes are by places that have human habitation, like there's someone always camping there for the summer. Whereas a bear bait, I don't know if they're necessarily relating that to human activity. They're just finding
something.
Yeah. Donuts and dog food out in the middle of the woods.
Yes. And of course, I've just strayed away from the trapping topic, but I was sort of going toward, well, could we somehow identify where the traps are? But there are an awful lot more traps out, I suppose, than areas where bear bait's been placed.
Oh, yeah, by far.
Yeah, it would be maybe a bit onerous for the trapper to have to identify with some sort of tag where they placed a trap. But
some do. They put out a sign. But then they also find that there's people that will go out there and take all their traps.
Oh.
So they run that balance of, do I be a good neighbor or do I hang on to my very expensive traps?
I see. I can see that.
Hmm. Are there any trap-free zones in the Panhandle for recreationists?
There's not. Not that I can think of. The only place would be Sam Owen Peninsula, where there's you can't hunt, trap, or fish. That's it.
Sure. Yeah. A listener had a question about snares versus the squishing traps. Is there is one more humane than the other? Is one a better trap than the other?
Well, a snare theoretically will kill that animal within minutes. Where a foothold trap, or a squishing trap. a foothold
terminology,
trap.
Terminology, Julie. Yeah.
A foothold trap will hold that animal there. And it's not something out of the movies where there's spikes and it doesn't do any damage unless they really fight it. But it just holds their paw there. And then some of them have rubber on it. Some are offset so it doesn't break bones. But then if the trapper's doing the 72-hour trap check time, that animal's in the trap for 72 hours. And that can be brutal, and if it's 8 degrees on an animal that needs to eat and move, and snares are pretty, humane, they're pretty efficient, more humane. Yeah.
Yes, I see that. Yeah. I can understand that. Yeah. So trapping, it's a contentious issue, and that's not our purpose here today. More to just explain and help people understand that. But for the pet owners, of course, at least the season isn't forever, so there are several months they need to be careful. And for the trappers, of course, they have a short season. Hopefully, can get some prime fur.
Yes. Yeah. Then the main trapping season for fur bearers will be done February sometime, but wolf trapping will continue, and that's typically out in the tulies. That's not close by, but sometimes it is. So it's, you never know.
So any advice for or resources for the pet owners who are out in the field, they find their dog caught in a trap, what they should do, what they should carry with them, what the correct thing for them to do is?
There's a couple things. One of them, if they know a trapper, most trappers are willing to explain how to release. And it's very simple. Once you see, oh my gosh, okay, that's really easy. Mm-hmm. You just step on the two wings on the side of the trap. Releases the grips, the arms, and you can pull the dog's foot right out. Typically, no damage. Snares are a little bit different. Depends on how your dog's, if it's leash trained or not. When dogs get in a snare, they usually just sit down because they feel that tension. It's when they start to pull that keeps cinching down, and then the asphyxiation. But the best thing to do is to get together with a trapper. And learn that. Or we have video on our website of how to release a dog.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And so they would find that by going to?
I don't know our website. It's, I just Google Idaho Fishing Game. Yeah. Yes. It's like fishinggame.gov.
Or, I think a couple years ago there were classes too that Idaho Fishing Game put on. Are they still doing those?
I do believe they do, yeah.
I think so. I think I saw some this fall, guys. So I'm not sure if there are any left. The trapping season is underway, but I know that they've been available this year.
And then the other thing you can bring, as you asked, you could bring little tiny bolt cutters or something to cut that snare if you need to. That's always good to have.
Yeah. Sure.
And then, of course, they should report that back to Fish and Game.
Yes, because then the trapper shows up and he's wondering, did I lose a wolf in this trap or did someone sabotage my trap? So. Right. We always try to play middleman in that situation and just give us a call and and the trappers usually will move their traps and they don't want any part of it. So.
Sure. But you can help, trappers and, others work those sort of situations.
Absolutely.
Work them out. Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, Phil, I think it's time to move on to a topic that I know you've been waiting to address and that's the new trespass law.
Yeah. We should talk about that. There's, within the last year, there have been new regulations passed. Perhaps, Matt, you could describe some of the differences in the regulations and the consequences that are in play now.
Sure. Generally, it's kind of the same, except there's more onus on the hunter or the recreationalist to know where they are. I think we were kind of spoiled for years where we didn't see a no trespassing sign or blaze orange on a tree. Then we could go on the land, even though it was private. Now that's not the case. So... you don't have to have the standard 660 feet of a sign or blaze orange. If it's fenced, you don't have to have any signs. Like in the past, if it was agriculture, it was cultivated, you didn't have to have any signs. And that's still true with this new law. If you're adjacent to public ground, like Forest Service, you still have to post the corners of your property. If you have a fence, you don't have to post it anymore. Mm-hmm. I think the way the law is written, it says if it appears to be owned or someone, it's, you know, occupied land, then the onus is on the hunter.
In places, though, backing up to those corners, sometimes those corners are a long ways apart.
So
if you're in the middle of that section, literally a square mile, you might not see the corners and realize.
That's correct. Yep.
So what is the best way for the person who's out in the country to figure out where they are and know that they're not trespassing?
The best way, I think, and it may not be popular, but to get the Onyx Maps app on your phone, that's not 100% accurate. So it's good to back that up with maybe looking at an assessor's office map, see if there's any ownership, but that's the best way. If not, I would ask around, knock on doors and say, who owns this land? Just do a little homework, I guess, is what the...
It's always been good. And in fact, very important to know before you go into a place, whether you're hunting or hiking, that it's public land or that you have access through permission from the owner. And that's not changed, but what's changed are the signage requirements. And so people who might not have done the research beforehand now can't depend on being out in the field and it being so obvious.
True. Right. And tell us a little bit more about Onyx. Is that something people can just find? Is it free? Do they pay for it?
They pay for it, but it's, to me, it's pretty nominal fee. It's $20 for the year, I think it's $29. For the app, and that's constantly updated. So it's a company based out of Missoula. They are constantly getting updates from assessor's office, from whatever map you want to download, if you want Idaho. And you can see who owns the land. It's very specific on the land ownership.
Yeah, considering what might happen if you had a trespass violation, it seems a relatively small fee to pay to be sure of where you are.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
When you think a Forest Service map runs about $12, and that gives kind of decent ownership lines. Mm-hmm. And for $30, you can have very definite.
And it crosses multiple states. So.
It depends on what map you want to order. Yeah, okay. You can.
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about the trespass violations, because they are steeper than they once were. What happens if you trespass?
Well, it's on a tier system now. So the first time you trespass, I think it's like $500. And if it's a hunting trespass, you'll lose your license for a year or up to 3 years, but you'll definitely lose it for one. And then it keeps going up. Mm-hmm. So the second time you're convicted, now you're going to pay a little bit more. I don't know what that actual number is. And then the third time, I think it's $5,000 and it's extremely severe.
Yeah. So, the third one's a felony, isn't it?
It is.
It's not. So it moves from being a misdemeanor violation into a felony code.
Yeah.
So pretty serious consequences, and that's one of the changes as well. And so it's if it weren't important enough for folks, this should make them take notice.
Yeah, and this is not just for hunters. It's for
right.
all recreationalists that they're not trespassing. And then mm-hmm. on that other end of the fines, there's also an infraction, which is the least of fines. But if you're just on property and you didn't do any damage and you weren't hunting, that's an infraction, trespass. It's a, what do they call it? Where you don't cause any damage. Mm-hmm. So you're just on the land.
Right.
So before that was kind of just looked away. Sheriff's office would consider that a civil matter.
Yeah.
Sure. And now that's a infraction. It's a criminal matter.
So it would actually mm-hmm. go on your record.
It would.
At this point. Okay. Yeah. So that is a big difference. Mm-hmm. Big difference.
Yeah, huge difference. Luckily, I didn't have any I had one trespass case that was worked out between the owner this year. I think people are paying special attention. They don't want to have that.
Mm-hmm. But really important for people to be aware of if they've been used to operating a little differently when they're out in the wild lands and crossing other folks' property.
Yeah.
Very important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's move on to from trespass to the season of violations. Has there been anything really interesting? You don't, of course, have to name names here, Matt, but anything that was unusual or maybe worth mentioning so that people can be careful?
There really was. Going back to what we were talking about, the size of our patrol areas, it's impossible to cover. So we really appreciate when people call in, because we need to self-regulate as sportsmen and recreationalists. So I had one, somebody had called in and their neighbor had shot two deer, and she was just tired of it. I guess he's done it before. And she called in, and there was no way I would have ever made that case. The guy didn't have a hunting license, didn't have a tag. That's not interesting, but it's, mm-hmm. I like to talk about it because when people call, it really helps.
Shows and, cooperation.
Yes.
Sure. You wouldn't know otherwise.
Yeah.
Right. That's right.
What are some of the more frequent violations that you come across?
The more frequent violations are usually an oversight. They're not a flagrant violation. Like tagging issues. The tag's not attached to the animal. It's in their pocket. The law says it has to be attached to the animal. Evidence of sex. You have to, when I look at an animal, I have to be able to see if it's a white-tailed deer and if it's a buck. And people say, well, it has antlers. Well, they have to be attached.
Sure.
So if you don't leave the antlers attached, you got to leave other parts attached that I can tell that it's a buck.
Yeah.
So that's a huge one. People say, oh, I didn't realize that. And it's an oversight for sure, but they still need to adhere to those laws.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And what about the topic of, just wanton waste and seeing field-dressed animals by the roadside, that sort of thing? Because there does seem to be a lot of that during the deer season. You see lots of little deer body parts here and there.
If people get lazy and they dump them, I don't know why. They can take them to Colburn Culver and dump them. Or they could put them in the woods, but be more discreet about it, in the side of the road in a tarp.
Right.
It's just disgusting. Yeah. So... as far as waste goes, the law requires all four quarters and the back straps to be consumed. So the neck meat and the rib meat can stay on the animal, unfortunately. Mm. Most hunters take the neck meat and the rib meat because that is a lot of meat. But it looks like waste. As you drive by, you think, gosh, it's a whole deer there. They just,
Right.
So.
But it's not technically waste.
Correct.
Okay.
The other side of that is salvage. Fairly recently, some new salvage laws in place.
Yeah, I believe that was 2014, I think. You can pick up any animal that's been killed on the side of the road that you could legally keep. So obviously, if a grizzly bear gets hit, you can't keep that. Or if a swan gets hit, you can't keep that because they're not huntable animals. But you can salvage any part of the meat. You don't have to. There's no waste associated with it. If it's a deer and the whole front end's destroyed because it got hit by a car, but the back end is in good shape, you can just use the back end and throw out the front end. So
how does that seem to be working out? I know at the time it was implemented, there was a lot of positive talk about it, but also some potential for negative consequences.
I think it's worked out great. I mean, I was all for it. I think a lot of us in the panhandle were for it because we're the king of roadkill up here. By far, we outnumber the rest of the state. The officers in the other parts of the state thought, oh, this is a green light for people just to mow down animals, and that's not happening.
Right.
So,
I can't think anyone would really want to hit an animal.
It's those pesky trees. They make things hard to see.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there a reporting requirement for the salvage? Do you need to call Fish and Game?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. You can. It's as simple as going onto our website, just Google Idaho Fishing Game and go into the bottom corner, I believe it is, the very bottom of the home page there, and there's a deer crossing sign, and underneath it says report wildlife collision, vehicle collision. Click on that, and it's very easy. You just fill out all the required, and then print a tag right from there.
Sure. So. Matt, you mentioned the one story of the neighbor who called her on her neighbor who was in an obvious game violation. But how does turn-in poachers work in our state? Are there many call-ins about that? Is it a big problem here?
It is. There's a lot of our what we call CAP call. It's Citizens Against Poaching line. It's completely funded by private money. It's not a department program. They get thousands of calls a year, and a majority of those aren't necessarily a violation in progress. It could be I have a moose in my backyard. It's basically a misuse of 911.
Yeah.
The CAP line is for wildlife violations. They're not for hey, a bird just hit my window, that kind of thing. But if you do call the line, there is reward money, and it's set. If like a moose is $500, big game $250, small game $100, but sometimes those people who call go above and beyond what they should do. They took a license plate number down. They gave a great description. We wouldn't have been able to make the case. We can petition for higher amounts, and the CAP board has almost never declined that. So we've had people get $1,000, $1,500 for their part in calling in. And some people flat out decline.
Yeah.
The money, they say, I didn't do it for
they
the money.
Do it for money.
No, yeah. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Well, in our state, we have so many great game species, and who wants to see flagrant misuse of our game animals? Yeah. I mean, a moose, if someone were to poach a moose, it would be a terrible thing.
It would be. It is.
Yeah.
We had a moose poaching this year, and just like I was talking about, someone made the call. This individual shot a moose, thinking it was an elk, covered it all up, and drove away. And the only description was it was a white, well, I won't say it, but it's been in the news, but it was a white vehicle with a certain plate on it.
Yeah.
And Officer Morris, Rob Morris down in Sagal, made a great case on it, went through all the vehicles with that plate style and that car description, came up with someone with an elk tag and knocked on the door. And the guy said, yeah, I did it.
That was quite a bit of work, and what it great is. Detective work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did a great job. So just another example of someone calling in.
Quite a multifaceted job. So before we go, what's new that we haven't touched on?
What's new? Oh, squirrel season.
Yeah,
yes, that's new. Let's talk squirrels for a moment.
Yeah,
which squirrel?
It's the pine squirrel, or red squirrel, the one that always chatters at you when you're hiking or hunting. Yeah. We have not had a season in Idaho, as far as I know, forever. And I think we were challenged by some people that said, hey, why aren't we allowed to harvest these things? Squirrel seasons or squirrel hunting is extremely popular in other parts of the country. And so it's just another opportunity. It's great. You can take 8 squirrels a day. Season goes till March 31st. It's great for kids. I mean, my kid really wanted to get out there and we have, and I've been skunked. I can't believe it on squirrels. But
well, that's because it's a squirrel season, not a skunk season.
At the risk of opening a topic that could probably be a whole show, really just looking for the short answer. New year, new governor, new Idaho Fish and Game director.
Yeah.
New changes envisioning, or pretty much stay the same?
I think it's going to be status quo. I mean, with Governor Little in there, he was pretty much follows that same line of Governor Otter. And our new director, Ed Schriever, was a great guy. He's followed under Virgil Moore's tutelage. So I think that they're cut out of the same mold, and it'll be status quo.
Yeah.
With, their own little touches here and there. And
both of them have been around a while.
They have, yes.
Sure. Yeah. Back to squirrels for just a moment, guys. not gray squirrels, only the red squirrels.
Well, the gray squirrels are introduced, so that's they're not protected. So you could always have shot those. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like the collared dove. That's another one can be hunted at any time.
Yeah. That's a great source of meat. Those doves are delicious.
They are.
Yeah.
Any other invasive species like that folks hunt throughout the year, or are those the two main ones?
I don't see a lot of popular. You can shoot starlings. A lot of the, I'm trying to think of some introduced.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm having a mind blank. Sorry.
It's all
right. Yeah, there's some out there that you can shoot.
Sure, yeah. But those are two kind of important ones, the gray mm-hmm. squirrels and the collared doves, although they tend to be in the cities quite a bit.
They do, so it's hard to hunt them, or mm-hmm. illegal.
Well, any other regulations we're forgetting about? Anything new hunters and outdoors people should be aware of in this new year?
The only thing I can think of is go out and get your new license, which I need yep. to do. Get your 2019 license and
new year.
Yes, yeah. And support Fish and Game because that's a revenue source.
It is. We don't operate on any general fund money. So
that's right.
Well, Matt, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
It's always good to have you on the show.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
I feel updated, Phil. I think I've got enough info to make it through most of 19. Thank you, Matt.
You bet. Thank you.
Just wait till fishing season.
That's right. Yeah. Well, in honor of the mighty squirrel, we'll be listening to Squirrel on a Fence Post and then back with